From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Witnesses at the Robert Gates confirmation hearings have testified that Gates slanted CIA reports to support the agency's ideological agenda and its covert operations. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss one of the CIA's most controversial covert operations of the 80s, the funding of Nicaragua's Contra rebels. My guest will be Sam Dillon of the Miami Herald, author of the new book Commandos. Also today, we talk with Joanne Folletta, conductor of the Bay Area Women's Philharmonic. The orchestra performs newly discovered works from the past, as well as new music, all composed by women. And our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, who is also a poet, welcomes autumn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Haiti's deposed president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, is in Washington preparing to appeal for help from an emergency meeting of the Organization of American States. Shortly before Aristide's arrival, President Bush said that he's not inclined to use American force to restore Haiti's first freely elected government. The president said he would support OAS sanctions against the military junta that seized power on Monday. Defense officials said today that the United States is sending a contingent of fewer than 500 Marines to Guantanamo Naval Station in Cuba in case they're needed to help evacuate Americans from Haiti. The officials stressed that the Marines would be used only in a rescue effort and only on orders from the State Department. President Bush said today that he'll veto the unemployment benefits bill that Congress has just approved. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Speaking to reporters on the White House South Lawn, Mr. Bush criticized the Democrats' new bill to extend benefits to the unemployed.
What I want is a bill that doesn't bust this budget. I've made that very clear from day one. We are prepared to extend unemployment benefits. In fact, I'd like to see it done, but I am not going to go and put the burden on all the rest of the people in this country.
Mr. Bush said he is prepared to sign an unemployment benefits bill sponsored by Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole, and he accused the Democrats of playing partisan politics with the issue. I will not let the Democrats set the agenda for this country, said the president. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
As preparations for a Middle Eastern peace conference gain momentum, Israel's Foreign Minister David Levy addressed the United Nations General Assembly today. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
Last week, President Bush called for the repeal of the 1975 resolution equating Zionism with racism, and Soviet Foreign Minister Boris Penkin endorsed the move. Today, Israel's foreign minister defended Zionism as a tolerant and liberal philosophy that is colorblind. And he expressed hope the repeal would come soon. From the podium, David Levy appealed to Arab countries to halt the arms race, and he reaffirmed Israel's willingness to ban chemical weapons as long as all Arab countries agreed. He also said that arms control must include conventional weapons as well as weapons of mass destruction. Levy reminded the assembly that Israel was attacked by Iraq during the Persian Gulf War, but refrained from counterattack in order not to upset the international coalition. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
Stock prices dropped slightly today on Wall Street. Analysts said investors are holding back as they wait for government unemployment figures that are due out on Friday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 6 points to close at 3,012.52. Declines edged advances in active trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 166 million shares. This is NPR. A top United Nations inspector said today that documents seized from Iraq show that many foreign companies contributed to Saddam Hussein's effort to build nuclear weapons. Bob Gallucci, speaking with reporters in Bahrain, declined to name the companies but said the ones he knew of were mainly European. A source at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna said today that the agency is threatening to publicly name companies that worked with Iraq if the UN Security Council does not. Some members of the Security Council reportedly want the names released only to the company's home governments. On the eve of the first anniversary of unification, the German government condemned ongoing attacks against refugees. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
A report presented to the cabinet from the Interior Ministry said there were 49 attacks last weekend alone against refugee shelters. At least 5 additional attacks were reported today. Chancellor Helmut Kohl called the attacks assaults against the democratic state. A federal minister and a state governor visited refugees today whose shelters were attacked recently, the first such solidarity visits by top government officials since the nonstop attacks began in mid-September. At a protest march in Frankfurt, about 5,000 demonstrators called on ordinary citizens to help protect the foreigners. Police fear heightened attacks against foreigners tomorrow on the anniversary of unification. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Experts in the gold market predicted today that gold prices could skyrocket if it's true that Soviet gold reserves are very low. Last week, a leading Soviet economist said that the Soviet Union has secretly been selling gold to pay for imports and to service its debt. Grigory Yavlinsky said that the Kremlin's gold holdings had fallen to just 240 metric tons. That came as a shock to Western experts who believed the Soviets had at least six times that much and who feared that the Soviet Union might dump gold on the market and depress the price. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Robert Gates confirmation hearings are currently investigating whether Gates slanted intelligence reports to fit the CIA's ideological agenda in the Soviet Union, the Middle East, and Latin America. And the question remains, how much did Gates know about the Iran-Contra affair? And if he didn't know anything, how did he manage to stay so uninformed? My guest, Sam Dillon, is the author of a new book investigating one of the CIA's most controversial covert operations of the 1980s, its funding of Nicaragua's Contra rebels. Dillon is a reporter for the Miami Herald. He was part of a team of reporters that won the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of the Iran-Contra scandal. I asked him if the Contra Army was really a creation of the CIA.
It was not a CIA creation in its first year, but on the other hand, it wasn't much of an army then either. The original Contras, that maybe amounted to about, say, 200, carried out a series of minor uprisings, ambushes, armed rebellions in northern Nicaragua in the years 1980 and early 1981. They fled to Honduras and were essentially refugees there when the Reagan administration decided to build a paramilitary force to confront the Sandinistas. And at that point, they immediately, what had been not much of an army ceased to be what it had been and definitely became a CIA-created military force. They were completely made over. They were enlarged many times their original size. They were given sophisticated weaponry, and the CIA controlled them throughout the rest of the war.
How did the CIA recruit Contras?
Well, they recruited the commander of the Contra force through most of the war. His name was Enrique Bermudez. He was a guard colonel who had been
From Somoza's National Guard.
Yeah, he had worked. He had a 30-year career in the National Guard. Had been at the time of the Sandinista revolution in 1979, Somoza's military attaché in Washington. And within months of the Sandinista revolution in 1979, was in contact with the CIA, and within a year and a half had begun traveling in the region, putting together the force. He recruited, he and his associates recruited an officer corps. You know, they worked the phones. They had money from the CIA to pay these officers. And they did it exclusively from the ranks of the former guard, the defeated guard. The fighters came from, in the first days, they were refugees who had fled Nicaragua to Honduras. But then the leaders of those refugees were then recruited by Enrique Bermudez to go back into Nicaragua and carry out a recruiting campaign for fighters. And some of the fighters that were recruited did so voluntarily, and some of them didn't. Some of them were coerced in a variety of ways to join the force.
Was there a division within the Contras between those people who genuinely wanted to join and were, you know, had a personal motivation to do so, and those people who were recruited for money?
Well, yeah, that was the difference between, that was the tension in the force throughout the war. It was a tension between what was essentially a mercenary army and the patriots of the force who were fighting for principle and in, to whom money was not much of a motivation. The Air Force, the politicians, the logistical men, the medical corps, much of the officer corps, these were mercenaries who received salaries, $800 a month, $1,000 a month, $2,000 a month. And that money was a powerful influence in their thinking. The fighters weren't mercenaries. They got nothing and fought essentially for principle. There were continual divisions between the peasants and the guards.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sam Dillon, and he's a reporter for the Miami Herald. In fact, he was part of a team of reporters that won a Pulitzer Prize for their investigation of the Contras. Dillon is the author of a new book called Commandos, the CIA and Nicaragua's Contra Rebels. Now, the CIA chose the leaders of the Contras, and you say that the Contras became divided into two parts, a military part and a political part, and the CIA chose a different kind of leadership for each. For the political leadership, you say that they chose people who were familiar with the United States corporate world and who had a good ability to come north and talk to Congress and be very persuasive.
That's right. One of the most famous of the political representatives was Adolfo Calero, who was professionally, he was the manager of the Coca-Cola factory in Managua. And there were a number of others of the early FDN directorate who were the representatives in Managua of some U.S. Corporation. That was a problem. That became a serious problem in terms of articulating the political goals of the movement, because all these peasants that were fighting in the war had their own motivations for taking up arms against the Sandinistas. They were land disputes. They were questions of local authority. They resented police abuses. And they had quite a different set of, their agenda was badly articulated, but it was there. On the other hand, the businessman that the CIA recruited in salary, they had a completely different agenda, and which was partly dictated to them by the CIA in order to influence the Congress. In other words, essentially an American agenda, and so that's a continuing problem. Many of the problems faced by the demobilized Contras in Nicaragua today are serious because although they shed the blood and did the fighting, they really weren't taken into account in the negotiations.
What didn't they get that they wanted?
Well, among other things, they didn't get the land that they were promised, although there have been a number of attempts to distribute land to demobilized Contra fighters. Thousands of them remain landless, as they were before the war started. And then in terms of security, the most serious problem that they face is that the Sandinistas continue to control the police in northern Nicaragua. The process that occurred at the end of the war was that the state security director, which was the plainclothes police force under the Sandinistas, was technically abolished, but in dozens and dozens of towns across rural Nicaragua, the local state security agent just ceased to be the state security agent and became the local police chief. And we have the OAS has reported about 70 murders this year of Contras. Well, all of these things could have been there. They were not on the agenda in the final negotiations. And in retrospect, part of the problem was that the people that were doing the negotiations were these business people who were originally recruited by the CIA and had their own agenda that they looked after in the negotiations.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Sam Dillon. He's a reporter with the Miami Herald and author of the new book, Commandos, the CIA and Nicaragua's Contra Rebels. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Journalist Sam Dillon is my guest, author of the new book Commandos, the CIA, and Nicaragua's Contra Rebels. Let's get back into some of the history of the Contras, and then we'll talk some more about what the status of the new version of the Contra Army is now. How did, you know, after the CIA virtually recreated the Contra Army, paid its leaders, paid a lot of the fighters, how did the CIA create the whole image of the Contra freedom fighter? You know, the image that was presented to us in America.
Well, they were aware of this, of the political liability that came with recruiting the guard, the former guardsmen to be the officer corps. One of the anecdotes or one of the sort of incidents that I learned of in the course of reporting the book was came about in it probably happened many times in the original training camps set up in 1981, where these guardsmen were training peasants to be a functioning army. You had CIA agents, you had Argentines, and you had Bermudas helicoptering into these camps to look things over and taking photos. And when Bermudas and the CIA men were setting up the photos, they invariably wanted the guardsmen out of the photos. They wanted the peasants to step forward and to be the, you know, front and center as the freedom fighters.
I realize this might be obvious, but why would it have looked so bad to accurately portray how many members of Somoza's former National Guard were actually in the Contra Army?
Well, because they were the guard had a very bad reputation, and during the fighting in 1978 and 1979 that ended in Somoza's defeat, carried out incredible abuses. At one point, they were dumping burning barrels of oil and kerosene out of planes onto their own cities in order to defeat the Sandinistas. So the American authorities who recruited these men needed them to make the force work as a military force. There was no doubt about that. But they recognized from the beginning that there was this liability, a political liability to them.
Did you learn anything about how the Contra Army was changed after the Boland Amendment in 1984 cut off official funds from America?
Yeah, I found that to be very interesting because Americans have tended to view the entire Nicaraguan war in terms of what they know about that Iran-Contra scandal, which just lasted a couple of years. What I have found interesting in talking to Contras about that period was that very little changed during that two-year period, while North was essentially in control of the army. Supplies dwindled, coordination was somewhat fragmented, but essentially it was the same war to them.
We're still trying to get to the bottom of what happened during the Iran-Contra scandal, but I'm wondering if you think that it's kind of scandalous how the CIA backed the Contras before the Boland Amendment, when it wasn't illegal for them to send money to the Contras. Do you think it's a scandal that the CIA presented the Contras to us as these great freedom fighters when in fact the CIA had created an army of mercenaries?
Well, again, the army was only part had an element in it that was a mercenary force. A lot of the fighters were fighting for different reasons, but it was a covert operation, much like I think many other covert operations that the CIA has carried out. These things tend to go wrong; they tend to go badly. It's not really that easy to overthrow an established government with a proxy army, and when the plans go awry and the results don't happen immediately, what tends to happen is that the covert operators look for increasingly harebrained schemes to bring results. And so there were a variety of wild and unfortunate things that happened in the early years before the Iran-Contra scandal burst onto the American scene. The funding cutoff that set up the scandal was itself the result of the CIA mining of the Nicaraguan harbors in 1984. This was a very bad idea. They were not Contras that did it. They were a completely mercenary force based in El Salvador that, using a mother ship, put maritime mines in the harbor at Corinto that damaged Soviet and Panamanian and Dutch and British and Japanese freighters. And when Congress got word of this, I mean, they just hit the ceiling.
The Iran-Contra scandal is, of course, an important subject in the Gates confirmation hearings. What do you want to know about Gates? If you were in the committee that was putting questions to him, what would you be asking?
Well, the atmosphere that's coming out of those hearings, it reminds me so much of the atmosphere that prevailed in Honduras during this war. This kind of atmosphere in which you weren't supposed to ask when Alan Fires, the Central American Task Force chief who testified a couple of weeks ago in the Gates confirmation hearings, was describing this ambiance that prevailed, where the president had made it clear that he wanted the Sandinistas to cry uncle, and he wanted his men to make it happen. And in that environment, illegal acts were the norm, and if you were a covert operator and you sensed illegality, you were essentially supposed to look the other way. I'm watching as Gates describes that he knew nothing of the Iran-Contra scandal until just days before the rest of the American public learned it on CNN. I just sense that this sort of look the other way attitude, it was very prevalent in Honduras. A number of people have asked me why, when all these abuses were so common and so widespread along the border, where the Contra army was brutalizing its own men, why didn't we know? And the reason is that the people that were working in the Tegucigalpa embassy, who routinely came across these abuses, refugee officials out along the border, I mean, they knew these things. But there was this environment in which you weren't supposed to report it.
So I think what you're suggesting here is that if Gates didn't know about the Iran-Contra story, it's because he didn't want to know. He was not listening for it. Do you know what I'm saying? That it was like intentionally not knowing. So,
well,
that
Fires was quite explicit about that. I was struck by the candor. He said there were things that you didn't want to know if you had to testify. And I'm sure that the most professional among them took that attitude. I mean, if Gates was in a position to know about all this, he was the deputy director of the CIA. Now, if he didn't know, why didn't he know?
There are some Contras who have rearmed, and they're being referred to as re-Contras. Why have they rearmed? What is that about now?
Well, it varies. There are about 600 demobilized Contras who have taken up their arms again. Some of them, and I would say the predominant faction among them, have taken up arms essentially in self-defense. I mentioned earlier how the state security agents, the Sandinista secret police, as the President Chamorro came in, just essentially made a horizontal shift and took on the post of local police chief. And there have been a series of unexplained killings of Contras. The OAS, who is monitoring the violence, has counted about 70 killings this year. There were about 70 killings last year. This makes the Contras that are out there unarmed feel very insecure, and that is essentially the principal demand that the re-Contras have when in the talks they've had with the OAS and the Chamorro government. They want the Sandinista police withdrawn from those rural areas. There is another tendency, I think, in the re-Contra groups, which is that some of the peasant fighters, the process of joining the Contra army was on one level profoundly liberating for a peasant teenager. They were given a rifle, and they were liberated from the process of having to crop fields, And I think that the reality is that many of the those who are influential in the Recontra movement are simply people who carried a gun for a long time and they came to like it. And so I think there's a fringe to this movement that is essentially just kind of banditry.
Well, there's tens of thousands of weapons still in civilian hands from the Contra days, and I think the government wants to round them up but is having a hard time doing it.
That's right, that's right. And from the Sandinista days, too, the Sandinistas, as part of their self-defense program, handed out, like you say, AK-47s are all over Nicaragua. It's not a problem to get a gun. You know, the danger in Nicaragua, and we're not recognizing it for the first time, the danger has always been that it would become a sort of a Beirut situation in which factions would proliferate and we would just have essentially a chaotic decades of war in which every dispute is solved by gunfire. Well, it's, you know, the idea that 70 people have been killed this year, 70 Contras, it's quite disturbing to Contras who are out there trying to resettle. But from the point of view of the OAS monitors, I think they make a good point. They say, you know, 70 deaths, it's a lot, but it's not really that many. And if you consider the sort of legacy of bloodshed that we're facing, this was a very, very profoundly bitter war. Brother killed brother. There were the feelings, the Sandinistas, for instance, that watched as Nicaraguans allowed themselves to be recruited into a CIA-dominated army. I mean, this was from the point of view of a Sandinista, this was just an extraordinarily treasonous act. Given this extremely polarized environment, the OAS people don't necessarily view the idea that 70 people have been killed as a failure. They remain optimistic that we're on the road to peaceful coexistence.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, well, it was lovely to talk to you.
Sam Dillon is the author of Commandos, the CIA and Nicaragua's Contra Rebels. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Even as a child, Joanne Folletta wanted to conduct a symphony orchestra. But as she got older, she learned that women don't conduct. Even in college, they tried to keep Folletta off the podium. Coming up, Folletta tells us about conducting the Bay Area Women's Philharmonic, an orchestra dedicated to performing old and new works by women. And our classical music critic, Lord Schwartz, who is also a poet, reads a poem for autumn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. Pentagon sources say the U.S. has deployed a contingent of Marines to Guantanamo Bay Naval Station in Cuba in case they're needed to evacuate U.S. citizens from Haiti. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The Marines left today from Camp Lejeune in North Carolina and are being sent, as one official told NPR, just in case they're needed to evacuate Americans. The State Department estimates some 8,000 U.S. citizens are in Haiti, where a military junta has overthrown the democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The Pentagon official said the troops number fewer than 500 and could fly by helicopter from Guantanamo to Haiti. There, the official said the Marines could be used to secure an area and evacuate the Americans. There is precedent for such an action. A Marine force was used to evacuate Americans during recent unrest in Liberia. President Bush said today he was not inclined to have U.S. troops involved in a possible attempt to restore Haiti's government. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
In Pittsburgh today, President Bush defended his economic program. He also used the trip to boost the Senate candidacy of his former Attorney General, Dick Thornburgh. The president said if he had more Republicans like Thornburgh in Congress, the administration's economic growth package wouldn't be gathering cobwebs on Capitol Hill. Mr. Bush again called for a cut in the capital gains tax and plugged his plan for tenant ownership of public housing. The Senate Intelligence Committee heard charges today from a former CIA Soviet analyst who accused Robert Gates of routinely slanting intelligence. Gates is President Bush's nominee to head the CIA. Today, Mr. Bush dismissed the charges and said he was confident Gates would be confirmed. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
With a quavering voice, Jennifer Glaudemans accused Robert Gates of overstating the Soviet threat in the 1980s and creating an atmosphere of intimidation within a division responsible for Soviet analysis.
Many, including myself, hold the view that Mr. Gates had certain people removed because of their consistent unwillingness to comply with his analytical line.
Committee members questioned six witnesses today about whether Gates has in the past tailored intelligence to suit his own views and the views of his superiors. President Bush told reporters Gates would never slant a report for political reasons and wondered why his critics were only coming forward now. One witness, a prominent CIA veteran, Hal Ford, was asked a similar question by the committee. He responded that he never expected Bush would renominate Robert Gates. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Senate has approved legislation that would give American workers 12 weeks of unpaid leave for the birth of a child to take care of sick relatives or to recover from a serious illness. The president vetoed a similar measure last year. On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 6 points. This is NPR News. The Senate overwhelmingly agreed today to President Bush's request and held up a proposed $10 billion in loan guarantees. The money would be used to help Israel build housing for refugees from the Soviet Union and Ethiopia. The loan guarantee legislation will now come before the Senate in January or February. That's in line with Mr. Bush's request for a 120-day delay. The administration wanted the postponement because of fears the new settlements could undermine a Middle East peace process. Yevgeny Primakov, the new head of the Soviet Intelligence Service, pledged today to work for openness and democracy in the Soviet Union. He also suggested that the agency would cooperate with the CIA. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
We will not spy on Soviet citizens abroad, Primakov told his first news conference today, and we will not tap telephones. Primakov said he wants to reorganize the Soviet spy service to place a greater emphasis on solid analysis of global and regional developments. And he said he would like to explore ways of cooperating with the CIA on international terrorism and drugs. Primakov said he would end the practice of using journalists as spies, and he would no longer use disinformation as an intelligence weapon. The new Soviet spymaster, who was President Gorbachev's special Middle East envoy during the Gulf War, denied he ever worked for the KGB in the past. His service will be separate from the KGB, which will no longer operate in the field of foreign intelligence. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
President Bush's entire budget proposal for NASA's planned space station has cleared the House. An overwhelming vote allotted $2 billion for Mr. Bush's top priority for space. However, the chairman of a panel that oversees NASA says the costly project may force other NASA programs to be eliminated or stretched out. Streets were flooded and schools were closed in Jacksonville, Florida today after torrential storms dumped 6 inches of water on the already rain-soaked area. You're listening to National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Bay Area Women's Philharmonic is an orchestra with a mission to perform neglected historical works by women and to perform new compositions by women. The orchestra is entering its second decade. My guest Joanne Folletta is beginning her sixth season as its conductor. She's also the music director of the Long Beach Symphony Orchestra and the Virginia Symphony. Before joining the Women's Philharmonic, she had won the Stokowski, Toscanini, and Bruno Walter Awards. The Women's Philharmonic has one recording, Baroquen Treasures, featuring music by 18th-century women composers. This composition, Sinfonia in C, was written by Marianne Martinez in 1770.
When you're looking at a piece from the early 18th century written by a woman, you're looking at a piece composed by a woman who has not had the benefit very often of significant training, compositional training. You're looking at a woman who's relying on essentially raw talent and that alone to create this piece. So as a conductor, you have to be even more creative about helping it work to the best of its abilities. And that's a great challenge. It's a great challenge to come up with a piece that's never been played, that you can't hear on a recording, that has errors in it, that perhaps, you know, needs work in certain areas, and to get that to the point where it can be a very successful performance.
You became the conductor of the Bay Area Women's Philharmonic in 1985. You'd already won several prestigious conducting awards. Did you ever have any reservations about accepting the Women's Philharmonic invitation? Did you think perhaps that conducting a women's orchestra would in its own way narrow your career because you'd be perceived as like an advocate of women's music rather than a conductor who could do anything?
Well, you know, Terry, I did have some reservations, I have to be honest, because first of all, I didn't know anything about music written by women. My training as a conductor had been very traditional. I mean, and I learned the established standard repertoire of the orchestral world. And when I was first approached by the Women's Philharmonic, I had a feeling that, well, what is this music? And could it really be any good? And it wasn't until I went out and took a look at scores and worked with the orchestra that I began to realize that this was a wealth of repertoire that was really good and very interesting to me. And I guess I didn't worry really about being typecast as a conductor, although I know that conductors do get typecast. But I think I've been lucky in that I've been able to work on a great deal of standard repertoire as well. Although now when I do guest conduct, very often people will specifically ask me, please do a piece by a woman or please bring one of the pieces from the Women's Philharmonic for our program.
You've said that when you were studying conducting with George Mester at Juilliard, that he showed you ways in which you were undermining your authority as a conductor. What did he point out to you that you were doing?
Working with George was very, very valuable for me because he had never trained a woman as a conductor because there was just so few of us. He became very aware of the fact that women are trained by society to be nurturing and not always to be demanding or expecting of excellence. So he pointed out to me ways in which I was using language, perhaps, in a manner that undermined my authority, or perhaps using an apologetic approach to the orchestra that again undermined my authority. He helped me see that I had to get rid of some of the trappings of what I had learned as a young girl growing up and learned to be more demanding, again, in a way that was comfortable for me.
Can you give me some examples of things that you stopped doing?
Yeah, well, he pointed out that very often I and women in general would use words like just and only in an apologetic way. For instance, I would say to the orchestra, well, let's just try it one more time. And he pointed out that none of my male colleagues would use well or just in that sentence. They would say, we'll do it again. And that kind of difference in language made me realize that perhaps I was uncomfortable with demanding. And yet, I had to learn to do that because that's what a conductor does.
In the orchestras that you've conducted outside of the Women's Philharmonic, do you feel that you were called on to prove yourself in ways that a man might not have been asked to?
Well, in almost all the orchestras that I've worked with, I have been the first and in many times the only woman that the orchestra has experienced on the podium. So yes, I think there has been a proving period. Orchestras in general tend to be suspicious of conductors, and you know they want to be sure that they're working with someone who's utilizing their time well, you know. So the fact that it was a woman engendered a kind of excitement, I'm sure, and also kind of a feeling, well, let's see what she can do. So I felt that I had to be more well prepared probably than any of my male colleagues, and I had to work in a way that was extremely professional. And what I found is that musicians respond in an extremely professional way, and I haven't encountered the overt kind of prejudice that perhaps we feared.
You say that musicians are often suspicious of guest conductors. Is it like a substitute teacher, you know, where we don't behave as well?
It is. And, you know, in conductors in general, you have to realize that to be a musician in an orchestra is not a natural progression, because when one is studying at Juilliard or at Curtis, you're not studying to play second violin last stand. You're studying to be another Isaac Perlman. You're studying to be a soloist. And then life, you know, works itself out, and there you are in an orchestra playing in the second violin section. But you still have those same desires. You still have that same kind of spirit of individuality. And then here comes the conductor, who is essentially going to be telling 90 or 100 people how to play it and what to do and how to phrase. So you can see that the role of a conductor is potentially a very difficult one, because you have to convince that group of great musicians, all of whom have their own ideas about how to do it your way and how to feel good about that. So I think orchestras in general tend to judge conductors rather harshly because of that, because they have such strong musical integrity of their own.
What do you wear when you're conducting for a performance?
Well, you know, the issue of what a woman wears on the podium is something that still has not been resolved, and I have to answer that by saying that in different parts of the country, I wear different clothing. My concern is always that whatever I'm wearing be non-obtrusive and enable people to listen rather than watch. And that's the reason, of course, why orchestra musicians wear black, because it is an oral experience, and we don't want to be distracting by what we wear. In San Francisco, for instance, I very often wear tails. And that, for a conductor, is the most comfortable, least limiting, least constraining costume or outfit, and it enables me to be very professional and to work well.
This is tails with pants or with a skirt?
Tails with pants.
Oh.
In other parts of the country, that hasn't been as well accepted. And so when I'm conducting in, let's say, Texas or Virginia or Georgia, I will wear probably a black skirt and white blouse and jacket, or a black dress with a jacket. Again, it's my aim is to make people feel comfortable so that they get beyond the idea that there's a woman on the podium and into what the music sounds like.
So if you wear tails in some parts of the country, do they think you're cross-dressing or something?
People have said that. It's so strange to me. People have mentioned that, you know, and I've always said, you know, this is a professional outfit for a musician, and it doesn't mean anything about, you know, men or women. It just means that this enables me to utilize the motions that a conductor needs to use, and to do it in a non-distracting way. But again, I think it still is an issue that hasn't been resolved for women on the podium, and maybe won't be for a number of years until we have enough women, perhaps, that a standard dress or outfit evolves.
My guest is Joanne Folletta, conductor of the Bay Area Women's Philharmonic. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Conductor Joanne Folletta is my guest. When you started studying conducting, were you ever discouraged from pursuing it because you were a woman?
Well, yeah, because, you know, I made up my mind to be a conductor when I was 13, and I didn't know at that time that women didn't conduct. It just didn't occur to me. I guess I was very naive. My parents were not musicians, professional musicians, so they didn't know. And the first I heard of that was when I was 18, and I entered the Manus College of Music in New York as a classical guitarist, and I told them that I wanted to study conducting. And they said, well, you know, women don't do that. And I said, well, why not? And they said, well, it's just never been done. I mean, it's just not something that would be accepted. So it took me an entire year to convince them to give me a chance to study. And that was the beginning for me, because then I was able to study formally. I was able to conduct my school orchestra. I was able to make progress and eventually go on to Juilliard, where I got my master's and my doctorate. And again, I think there was some reservation about, can a woman really be a successful symphonic conductor? But I'm really very grateful to them for taking that chance.
What were the stereotypes you were up against, the stereotypes of why a woman can't conduct?
Well, I think people still had in mind the image of someone like Toscanini as a conductor, someone who, well, first of all, was European. I mean, and Americans always struggle with that. Secondly, was a total autocrat, someone who could, you know, hire and fire people at will, who would throw batons at members of the orchestra, who would have temper tantrums. The idea of a woman behaving in that way was not one in which people felt comfortable. And I still think that women on the podium have to be very careful about how they use anger to inspire people. I'm not sure that it works as well for women at this time in our society as it does for men. But coming up against that image of like a Toscanini or a Bruno Walter or Herbert von Karajan, for women, it was a challenging step. And I think as the image of a conductor changed, at least in our country, as we began to realize that conductors needed to work in a more collegial way with their musicians, not necessarily less demanding, but more respectful, that the door opened for women.
Do you think that you're more careful about how you use anger because you're a woman?
Definitely. Definitely.
How?
Well, I've played in orchestras, and I must tell you that I've, you know, as a young person playing cello and looking up at the conductor and conductor getting angry at us, I found was a very powerful motivator. You know, he was angry and we had to do better. We had to please him. I found watching women that anger usually takes away from their authority. And I can't say exactly why that is, but there is still a strong discomfort level in our country and all over the world with seeing a woman expressing anger. So I found that for myself, I can use other emotions more effectively. I can use disappointment. I can use high expectation level. I can use, being demanding in the sense of wanting the very best for the sake of the music more effectively than if I got angry and indicated that in a way that, you know, a man might still be able to do with some good effect. I don't think it's fair, but that's the way it is.
Since you're not playing familiar works, whether the works are old or new, these are basically newly discovered, that means that the women in your orchestra have to learn new things all the time, perhaps more so than your regular orchestra would need to, because there is a certain amount of familiar music in the repertoire that's played at your typical concert. but not
absolutely.
For you.
Absolutely. And I think this is what makes the orchestra so remarkable, because we are asking the members of the Women's Philharmonic to play new pieces every concert. Every piece is new. We're asking them very often to read from manuscript, that is, not printed music, but the composer's own handwriting. We've asked them, and let's say in the case of Lily Boulanger, who's writing during a very serious illness, I mean, at the end of her young life, to read from her handwriting, which is extraordinarily difficult, yet these musicians are willing to do that. We're also asking a lot of our audience, Terry, when you think about it, because we are asking people to come into a concert not to hear Beethoven, not to hear pieces that they know, but to hear four or five absolutely new pieces, first time hearing for all of them. And I think it takes a great deal of trust on their part to come to that. And they are extremely receptive. They are the best audience, really, that I've encountered, because they are equally excited about hearing a piece by Fanny Mendelssohn as they are by hearing a piece by a composer who is 22 years old and just starting out.
The Bay Area Women's Philharmonic has one album of 18th century Baroque composers. And I'd like to end our interview by playing an excerpt of a piece that you are the featured lute soloist on. And this is a piece by the composer Camilla De Rossi. It was composed in 1709. Would you tell us a little bit about this and about why you wanted to perform it?
Well, this is a wonderful example of a composer who's totally unknown, who is a very, very gifted composer. This is a instrumental selection from The Sacrifice of Abraham, you know, written, of course, on the Bible story of Abraham and Isaac. And I was particularly charmed by it because the lute in the piece represents the angel who first appears to Abraham and tells him that he must sacrifice his son, and then, of course, at the very last moment reappears and says that since Abraham has shown so much faith, he doesn't have to do it now. And the work, I think, is a wonderful piece. I'm very, very proud that we found this work. It had never been recorded before, and I'm pleased to have been the soloist on it.
Well, before we hear this piece, let me say thank you very much for talking with us, and good
thank
luck with
you
your
too.
New season.
Thank you very much.
The Bay Area Women's Philharmonic begins its second decade this weekend at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco. The orchestra will make its East Coast debut at the Kennedy Center in January as part of the National Organization for Women's 25th anniversary celebration. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the Haitian coup?
President Aristides in the United States, Terry, speaking to the Organization of American States, and the man who overthrew him in Haiti is also speaking in the parliament there, and we will take a look at both men and what they have to say. We will also be covering the Gates hearing, where a number of CIA analysts said very uncomplimentary things about Robert Gates today, about slanted intelligence. We also will be covering taking a little bit of a look at politics and the end of the arms race.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, is also a poet, and we've invited him to read a seasonal poem. It first appeared in the magazine The New Republic, and it will be included in his new collection, Goodnight Gracie, which will be out early next year.
Leaves. 1. Every October, it becomes important, no, necessary to see the leaves turning, to be surrounded by leaves turning. It's not just the symbolism. To confront in the death of the year your death, one blazing farewell appearance. Though the irony isn't lost on you that nature is most seductive when it's about to die, flaunting the dazzle of its incipient exit. An ending that, at least so far, the effects of human progress, pollution, acid rain, have not yet frightened you enough to make you believe is real. That is, you know this ending is a deception, because of course nature is always renewing itself. The trees don't die, they just pretend, go out in style, and return in style, a new style. 2. Is it deliberate how far they make you go, especially if you live in the city, to get far enough away from home to see not just trees, but only trees? The boring highways, road signs, high speeds, 10-axle trucks passing you as if they were in an even greater hurry than you to look at leaves. So you drive in terror for literal hours, and it looks like rain or snow, but it's probably just clouds, too cloudy to see any color. And you wonder, given the poverty of your memory, which road had the most color last year. But it doesn't matter, since you're probably too late anyway, or too early. Whichever road you take will be the wrong one, and you've probably come all this way for nothing. 3. You'll be driving along depressed, when suddenly a cloud will move, and the sun will muscle through and ignite the hills. It may not last, probably won't last, but for a moment, the whole world comes to, wakes up, proves it lives. It lives. Red, yellow, orange, brown, russet, ochre, vermilion, gold, flame and rust. Flame and rust, the permutations of burning. You're on fire. Your eyes are on fire. It won't last. You don't want it to last. You can't stand anymore, but you don't want it to stop. It's what you've come for. It's what you'll come back for. It won't stay with you, but you'll remember that it felt like nothing else you felt, or something you felt that also didn't last.
Lord Schwartz is Fresh Air's classical music critic. He also directs the creative writing program at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. His new collection of poems, Goodnight Gracie, will be published in January. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Bob Balls, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as the full Senate begins its debate on the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court, we ask law professor Walter Dellinger to critique the confirmation process. I'm Terry Gross. That and more on the next Fresh Air.